And hello, everybody out there on the internet. We are broadcasting once again Wednesday morning at 10 o'clock Pacific time, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. in London. And this is another episode of Discussions with David, which is one of my various weekday broadcasts that comes to you on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance and KABU Community Radio and various other platforms as well. And then for those of you who are into podcasts, it all goes up in podcast form if you look for This Week with David Rovics on any podcasting platform. And today, our guest is a fantastic, just a phenomenal jazz musician and author of many books, which I'm a big fan of, both the music and the books, including provocative and thought-provoking histories and philosophical endeavors such as The Wandering Who and the wonderful comedic efforts such as From A to Zion. With no further ado, let me introduce to you Gilad Atzmon. Gilad, wonderful to have you here.
Nice to be with you again, man.
Yes, we'll see how long the show lasts before the broadcast gets turned off. Did you hear that Leila Khaled was not allowed to do a presentation on Zoom?
Of course. But I actually had something to say about it. You know, you introduced me as a controversial character, so I allow myself. We have to remember that the people who really started the no platform tactics, philosophy, practices, weren't actually the Zionists. They were the anti-Zionists, and in particularly the Jewish anti-Zionists. And when we look about it, and we look at it historically, it is something that started with the Jewish progressives and the Frankfurt School, and so on and so on. So,
We're talking about deplatforming. We're talking about what they often are calling cancel culture. And there's some debate about like whether cancel culture exists. And I would say that you're the most shining example of somebody who can tell us that cancel culture very much does exist. You are hounded everywhere you go.
It never silenced me, by the way. And it actually helped me to reach a lot of people. You know, in fact, nobody sold more books, Gilad Atzmon books, than including myself, and then Alan Dershowitz.
And did you hear that President Trump recently denounced the historian Howard Zinn on the whitehouse.gov website, and it was on all the media, where he said the children in America are learning incorrect history taught by with this, reading the books of people like Howard Zinn. I'm sure that will result in his books becoming a bestseller. But of course, it's helped getting some sales out of Alan Dershowitz.
Of course, Alan Dershowitz went on Fox News, and he came with a lot of lies. Actually, a lot of people who bought to the book, based on the recommendations of Alan Dershowitz, who basically denounced the book and said that it's a Nazi text, and I don't remember exactly what he said, probably that I'm kind of justifying Hitler or what, nonsense.
Yeah.
And they then contacted me, and he said, "No, you didn't. You know, you were lying." I said, "I wasn't lying. It was Dershowitz was lying, and this is what he has been doing."
Yeah, his life. Did they end up liking the book, or
you know, a lot of people like the book. I know that quite a few people, quite a few Jews, didn't like the book, and I understand it. This is something that people don't understand about my work. I also don't like a lot of things that I happen to say. I'm also disturbed. You know,
the world is a really fucked up place. You end up saying some really dark stuff, huh?
I end up saying dark, you know, kind of presenting some dark observations, not because I like to make everything look dark, because this is how I see things, and a lot of people are. They actually, it is something that I hear a lot. A lot of people who read me, and maybe in a way, even yourself, if I remember correctly, when you read The Wandering Goo, and I think that we didn't know before, you wrote something like, hang on, man, and this is something that every Jew knows.
Yeah. It just seemed obvious. And it was also stuff that nobody had said before. I mean, some of the points you were making were also made before by Shlomo Sanz. And I don't remember Shlomo Sanz being as controversial. But I mean, that's what, when I was told to denounce you initially, and then I read your book that had at that time just come out, I think. Yeah. Actually, it was the first ebook I ever downloaded, and it was it was fantastic. I loved it.
Thank you so much. So a lot of people tell me that actually everything you say is something that kind of we knew somehow. But if I have a talent, you know, and this is something, you know, like yourself, I'm also a musician. If I have any unique talent, I know how to make things very simple, you know, to present ideas that are quite complicated. I walk, you know, I turn them around till I manage to reduce them into few lucid concepts. And this is what I was doing with Jewish identity politics. I realized that the notion of Zionism is a very misleading notion. Why I realized it? Because I grew up in Israel many years before I realized that it was Palestine, and quite a few years before it, Israel itself started to see itself as the Jewish state. So I was born in 63, and there was no Zionism or Zionist concern or Zionist education or Zionist indoctrination around us. It just wasn't there. And I, at a certain stage in the 90s, 94 or something, I kind of moved to Britain, and I start to hear this notion, Zionism, or Zionism, they mean Israel. But when they criticized Israel, by then Israel started already to see itself as the Jewish state. It didn't see itself as the Zionist state. It never called itself the Zionist state. It started to see itself as the Jewish state. And I started to ask question, what is it? You know, if you call yourself a Jew, am I allowed to call you a Jew? If you call yourself a black nationalist, am I allowed to refer to you as a black nationalist?
Right.
And, you know, what is that kind of thing that you call yourself X, but I'm not entitled to refer to you as the way you define yourself? And I start to ask all those questions. And as I said just a few minutes ago, I realized that if a state calls itself the Jewish state, the first questions that we have to ask are, who are the Jews? What is Jewishness? What is Judaism? What are all those J words? How do they relate to each other? Why we are not allowed to refer to these words and to discuss them? And every time we want to say about something about Israel, we have to use the Z word, i.e. Zionism. And I realized, one of the first things that I realized, that nobody was brave enough to ask, what is this J thing? And I went into this minefield, And one of the first things that I found, and this is why you were asked to denounce me, was that actually there is no categorical difference between the so-called Zionist and those who call themselves Jewish anti-Zionists. It is two different tribal settings that are set to oppose one another. At large, the Jewish anti-Zionists, all they really do is interfering with the Palestinian Solidarity Movement, controlling the narrative, controlling the discourse, and they are doing it by a semantic intervention. What they really do, they make sure that the language that we are using fits with their sensitivities. So, for instance, I think that every Palestinian would agree that the right of return is at the core, the right of return of the Palestinian people, of course, is at the core of the Palestinian struggle. It was very important for Jewish anti-Zionists, we call them usually AZZ, anti-Zionist Zionists, it was very important.
Anti-Atzman Zion. Anti-Atzman. No, what was there's no, a few
it was the ADL, the Atzman Defamation League.
Yeah, the Atzman Defamation League. Yeah.
Some people call them the ADL, yeah. Yeah, it was very important for them to change the discourse, to start to talk about end of occupation, for instance. End of occupation. In practice, and it sounds great. It sounds great unless you understand what it really means. End of education. End of occupation really means, in practice, the continuation of the Jewish state as it is, but maybe in a just a slightly different borders. I realized that
because by end of occupation they're talking about end of the occupation of the 1967
exactly, and they
back
really
to the 48 borders
exactly, and they don't address the Nakba, which with the ethnic cleansing, the massive ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people,
the so-called Independence Day.
So I understood that the Jewish left project, when it comes to Palestine, and I think that on many levels, you know, we can discuss other topics, is a duplicitous project. This is when I wrote The Wandering Who, when I continued to look into other Jewish solidarity projects. I was devastated. I'm saying it again.
And
I was.
Can I just clarify, Gilad, having read your book, when we're talking about, I'm not looking at comments, but when you're talking about Jewish solidarity, the left Jewish Zionists, you're talking about specifically people that who are organizing as Jewish leftists, right? And I just want to make that point, because there's a lot of people who, you know, if they haven't read your book, for example, they're not going to be clear on that. And it's, I think, an important distinction, because obviously, and I mean, to us it's obvious, but just for listeners out there, because I know they're going to be asking about this, there's millions of people out there of Jewish lineage who are not organizing as Jews, and you know, as that being their primary identity, you know, and that's so okay. Just please proceed.
It is very important that you mention it. Usually, you know, the Wandering Who came was published in 2011, so I kind of didn't think that we are going to talk about it, but since you raised it, it's very important that I make some.
Since they called you controversial, well, I have other questions though. I mean, because I have many other questions, but we can talk more about The Wandering Who.
So the revolution, the Copernican revolution, kind of introduced in this book, was that I, rather than looking at Jewishness in terms of religion, because most Jews are not really religious, and or understanding what it is racially, which is definitely something that I've never done, and I don't really believe in it. What I did, and this was quite unique, especially because it was done in 2011. At the time, not many people, or maybe no one, spoke about identitarianism in a critical manner. It was just the beginning. What I did, I took an interesting path. I said, instead of asking what Jews are, which is an endless question, and you can fall into a racialist approach, I didn't want to go there. I actually took a different path, and I think that it's a very interesting path. I said, instead of asking what Jews are, I will ask what those who identify, self-identify as Jews mean by their self-identification. And this is something that I did in the very, if not in the first page of the book, in the very first pages of the book. I'd say it's a while since I saw the book myself, so I don't remember, but it was kind of really in the first 2-3 pages. I said it is quite simple. We are talking about basically 3 categorical identifications. Some people identify themselves as Jews because they believe in the Torah. And I argue that this is pretty much an innocent group. And I looked at the time at Torah Jews as an exemplary case. Here, people who identify as Jews because they follow the Torah, they follow Halacha, Law, Talmud, whatever. They're Jews by religion. And they're actually attempt to present a humanist approach that I felt comfortable with. The second group are those who identify as Jews because of ancestry. Their grandmother is Jewish, their cousin is Jewish, I don't know. And again, this is an innocent group. If your mother is Jewish, it doesn't make you into a war criminal. The third group, I argue, is always problematic. These are the people who identify politically, and now I address your comment, politically as Jews. And whether they are Zionist or anti-Zionist, it is always problematic because this is a group of people who identify politically with their biology. They identify politically as a race. So they're in as problematic as the concept of the Jewish state is, actually the Jewish anti-Zionist, as opposed to Zionists who happen to be of Jewish origin, are actually more racist, because in the Israeli Knesset, the third biggest party is the Arab party. I don't see any Arab party in Jewish Voice for Peace, for instance. This upset every one on the Jewish left, but I'm sorry, this is the truth. It is an undeniable truth. The damage that these people caused to the solidarity, to the Palestinian solidarity movement, by the way, they did also a lot of good things, but the damage, I'm always interested in damages, you know, something, you know, is undeniable as well, and I take a lot of credit for exposing it. And they really called for my disavow. They even managed to get 20 Palestinians. A few years later, we realized that this letter was actually was written by a few Jews. I know their names and so on and so on. But I wasn't disavowed. You know, a lot of people still follow my work. My book,
but anyone who does, I mean, of course, anybody who doesn't disavow you and is then subject to guilt by association with somebody who asks questions about identity that really upset some people. And I think it's this guilt by association thing. Then you also get accused of so many of the accusations against you are your willingness to communicate with people who have different.
By the way, I just had someone on my Facebook that came with this, you know, with this kind of accusations. And I tell you something, and I this is my approach. When I grew up, you could see, and I'm sure that the same, I grew up in occupied Palestine, in Israel. And I learned a lot. And in a way, you know, I'm not that troubled. And this is something that you can read in my writing. I'm not troubled with my upbringing. I think that it was a very rich culture, very revolutionary culture. I feel very comfortable with the early Zionist ideas, you know, and we can talk about it. I don't feel comfortable at all with the Zionist crimes and the way it evolved. But the original idea of Zionism appeals to me a lot.
But there's also so much more. I mean, I don't want to make things overly complex for whatever point you're about to make, but there's so much more to your identity and your terms of your culture and the music you do as well. I mean, your father is a Palestinian Jew, and you are playing a kind of music that is, I mean, I think, it, like as you were saying about your writing, that makes the idea of sort of Arab and jazz fusion sort of obvious, and so
of course, but this is the thing, you know. It's like there is something about the early Zionist philosophy that I do feel very comfortable with, and especially it is the criticism of the diaspora identity. And I just finished writing a piece about what is happening at the moment as we speak in New York with the Orthodox community. And these are supposed to be, many of them are the people who are supposed to be our brothers and sisters in the solidarity movement, the Orthodox Jews, Satmar, and so on. And I'm not so sure that I know about what sect exactly is involved in this. But we see the same problem in Israel and in America. You know, we see that Orthodox Jews are highly infected. They refuse social distancing and so on and so on. Now,
it's a problem with religious groups all over the world, isn't it? I mean, this is a consistent thing with lots of different religious groups, very much including Orthodox Jews all over the world. That they're some of the ones who refuse to do the social distancing.
I don't know. Listen, you know, I'm not. I don't know about other religious groups, and I don't know if there is any case of other religious group that they kind of is castigated now in the United States. But there is, at the moment as we speak, there is a battle in New York. Some rabbis vote to destroyed the Blasio, you know. I just saw a video and the Cuomo and Governor Cuomo and so on and so on. And it is very interesting for me, because just 2-3 days ago I published a paper about our right these Orthodox Jews are to be persistent and to take the line of herd immunity. In fact, they are the most interesting. They put into play the most.
You mean like herd immunity? Pursuing herd immunity, that kind of thing.
It is becoming clear now that they were following an ideological path. They brought all the kids to the yeshiva, the youngsters,
in order to sort of expose each other. Was that the idea?
Or expose them to COVID. And made sure that the society becomes immune as a collective. They basically did what the Swedish tried to do, and to a certain extent, they definitely did it kind of as a scientific experiment. These rabbis don't care about science. They don't know nothing about science. They did this project. However, where is the problem? The problem And we have exactly the same thing in Israel. It's amazing. The statistics is similar. In New York, the Orthodox Jews are 3 times overrepresented among COVID-19 cases. In Israel, exactly the same statistics. They are 3 times overrepresented. 40% of the cases are Haredi Jews, Orthodox Jews, while they are just 12% of the population. Yeah, so it's 3.2 factor 3.2 overrepresentation. What is amazing about it, and here comes the Gilad Atzmon twist to the story. I believe in herd immunity. I believe that they did the right thing, but it would be the right thing if they would surround themselves with ghetto walls and not communicate at all, or integrate, or assimilate, or expose their neighbors, the people around them. Because while the all of America, or at least New York, was making an effort to flatten the curve through lockdowns and so on and so on, these people were doing exactly the opposite. They were walking to expose each other.
Gilad Atzmon supports walled ghettos.
Yeah, no. I'm not saying that I'm supporting. I'm saying, where is the problem? This is a clash of civilization. This is a clash of civilization. So once two yeshiva boys like that are taking a ride in the subway or in Israel, going in a bus, it's a disaster. Because they become kind of a mega spreader.
Yeah, super spreader, like the president.
I don't want to use the word super spreader because it has a specific medical.
Oh, does it?
Definition. Yeah. No, it's like they have the 2080. I don't want to go there. So it's I was careful not to use super spreader. But what I'm saying, this is exactly a dismissal of otherness. So you see something and it's a conflict and blah, 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 and they already talk about anti-Semitism. But what we see, whether they understand it or not, and I think that a lot of rabbis understand how striking it is, this is where this dismissal of otherness, that is a complete outcome of chosenness, that comes to light. Now, why I'm so inspired with the early Zionist project? Because Zionism was a very simple promise to get rid of chosenness. They say, we diaspora Jews have a problem, and we have to become people like all other people. It was a promise to make the Jews into ordinary people. Now, I grew up with this dream, all right? When you read Shlomo Zand, the one thing that is most striking for me about his writing is nostalgia about the Israeliness, which is something that disappeared. Now, at a certain time, this is the topic of my new book that I kind of go back to.
That you're working on now?
I worked on it kind of 2 years ago and kind of was carried away with some music project and stuff. And then lockdown, I started to write about Corona. You know, I kind of was pretty much kind of a mathematician in my early life, you know. So the Corona brought it back after 30 years that I didn't touch, you know, all these graphs. It's because it was at a certain stage, it became very boring for me, and now it's very exciting. So when I look, anyway, I don't want to, let's talk about
the pandemic. I mean, yeah, okay.
the pandemic kind of got me.
There's a lot of other questions I want to. Yeah. Oh, this line of talking is so interesting, and so many of the points you were making about the three categories of Jews or Jewishness that are in the first chapter of The Wandering Who, if I recall. Just reading the first chapter I highly recommend.
There is one very important thing that I wasn't clever enough to say in The Wandering Who, and And once you understand these three categories, identify yourself as a Jew because of being a Torah follower, being a subject of ancestry, or third category, which is kind of identifying yourself primarily as a Jew and politically as well as a Jew. These categories, and I think that I didn't say it in the Wandering Jew, but it's really, really important that people understand it. They are not mutually exclusive.
No.
Many Jews fit nicely within more than one category. So if we take, for instance, a Brooklyn Jews who move kind of to Israel and become a West Bank settler, yeah, in most cases they are religious, so they fit within the category number one, which is not a problem, but they definitely fit there. Definitely Jews by origin. They come to Palestine in the name of the land that belongs to, you know, there is the ancestry is even more meaningful for them. And obviously, they identify politically as Jews. And this is the real core of the crux of the problem. If you take a JVP persona, in many cases, they are not religious, or they don't identify as religious Jews, or with they don't practice or anything. So no category number one. Usually, there will be an element of category two. There will be an element of ancestry. And the most problematic thing is that they will identify politically as Jews. Why it is so problematic? Because this is a racially exclusive setting. We are very peaceful with the idea of Jews for Palestine. Are the people who are so peaceful with the idea of Jews for Palestine will be also peaceful with the idea with Aryans for peace or white for Palestine? I can promise you that they will be very disturbed. But they themselves feel very comfortable with their racially exclusive political activity. This is what I, by the way, you probably know some of my arch enemies that denounce my work, blah, blah, blah. Most of them in England, for instance, were kicked out from the Labour Party for being so-called anti-Semitic.
It's getting easier and easier to be an anti-Semite in England today. All you have to do is say anything critical of Israel.
It's even more than that. You just tell the truth and you are out.
Then you're definitely out.
But what is most amazing is that quite a few of them, actually, they wouldn't admit it, but they actually copy my perception and my ideas to the hilt, you know, one after the other. They are now against a political, a Jewish exclusive political cells and so on and so on. You know,
I think, Gilad, you know, growing up in the United States as both someone of a Jewish lineage and also, but also just as somebody with a blue blood WASP lineage, both those are the two sides of my family. I always have been troubled by the whole concept of the chosen people and this identity. But I think that this kind of chosen identity is really common in so many different contexts, right? And for WASPs and for Americans generally who swallow the patriotic bullshit, you know, we are taught the same kind of thing, that manifest destiny. It's very much the same kind of thing as the sort of, Zionism, the same idea. And I wonder what you also as a musician traveling and have done a lot of performing all over the world, including in a lot of other settler colonial countries like the United States, Australia, Canada. And I wonder what I mean, you you kind of work, I think, in the book Wandering Who, maybe just because of just academic discipline, you don't go into outside of Israel, Palestine much, because it's just, I mean, or the Jewish identity, like in terms of comparisons and with Israel and the United States. I mean, you could go on forever with that. Obviously, you have to just limit yourself to one book, but I wonder what reflections you have on that.
This is a fair criticism. And maybe we didn't meet since then, since 2017 or whatever, because you're absolutely right. In The Wandering Who, I dig into the J question. I take it as a criticism, and I try to address this criticism because it is a fair comment. In a way, quite a few times in my life, I try to kind of escape this kind of Judeo-centric interest and to look, as you say, at American chauvinism, and you know, when you start to look at it, you know, the first thing that you will find out is that Marx understood it already in, I think, 1842, 1843, and he said exactly this is why the Jews go to America, because it's the Golden Medina, is the called. This is the real promised land. This is pre-Zionist. But in my next book, after, it wasn't the sequel, I should say, to The Wandering Who, Being and Time, I try to address identitarianism. So I took all my findings that are related to Jewishness, Zionism, and so on and so on, and try to apply them to the many identitarian movements that we see around. And I'm against all forms of biologically oriented identitarianism. So I'm very critical, not just of Jewish identitarianism. I'm critical of LGBTQ. I'm critical of the ideology. You know, I'm not critical of people who want to live. It's none of my business what they do in their in bed or under the sheet. You know, I'm talking about the idea of creating an exclusive cells that actually lead society towards deep fragmentation and the devastating impact that it had on the left. And I will elaborate on this point because it is very important, especially now when America is in election. What I wrote, and just after the previous 2016 election, I argued that the left that I grew up with and felt pretty comfortable with, I don't think that I feel very comfortable with it anymore. I think that it doesn't exist anymore. Had a very simple message, had a unifying message to all of us. They told us it doesn't matter whether you are a woman, black, Muslim, Jew, lesbian, whatever, you name it. We are all together against the bad guys.
And it's also, just to interject, as you point out in The Wandering Who, I think I've read it many other places as well, but Marx in his time was also very clearly denouncing the tendencies of what they called it, Bundism back then, talking about the idea of unity.
Marx, I think, was before the Bund, but definitely Lenin.
Or was it Lenin? Lenin, yeah.
Lenin definitely denounced the Bund, and I feel very comfortable with Lenin on that
point.
Actually, I think that I feel
comfortable with
Lenin, and I feel very comfortable with Stalin. You know, people are also kind of people want to get upset. I don't feel very comfortable with Trotsky. All right, now
you've just upset so many people just in one sentence. Do you work at that? Like, how can I upset? how can I compose a sentence so that with the beginning of the sentence I can upset one group, with the middle I can upset another, with the end I can upset another. So, by the end of the sentence, you have a room full of people fuming, and they're not all even sure, if they are on the same side of why they're fuming. You know,
Robert Wyatt told me a few years back. I miss him actually. When I'm in England, I must go to visit him and his wife. Robert told me once, Gilad, I can't imagine, you go into 1 hour interview and you manage to slap everyone around. You make sure that you don't have any friends. I feel okay. People say anti-Semitism. I really hate everyone equally. No, I don't hate anyone. But I go back to... Where were we?
You were trashing identitarianism, and I think also you were mentioning the elections, and I wonder. It's also I don't know if you've written about this, but the way that the various forces, apparently including Russian entities or whoever else, those who have tried to sow discord, which I'm sure involved lots of intelligence agencies from everywhere, but the way that they use identity politics in order to create even more divisions, and there's nothing new about that either. But this is
sure. But I leave the Russians out of it. It's a very interesting topic, but it's not my topic. So while the old left tried to unite us, suddenly at a certain stage, the left started to expect us to speak as a woman, as a Jew, as a lesbian, as a gay, as a black, as a Muslim. And they created a total fragmentation of the society. And while it was very clear that society is broken, instead of fighting the bad guys, we are fighting each other.
And it's very much engineered, wouldn't you say? I mean, it seems to me that this whole process began at least in the United States, to a large extent, it was with the betrayal of the working class by the Democratic Party. Okay. And if they're not going to represent the working class and they want to win elections, then they have to appeal to somebody. So they appeal to their sort of so-called intersectional diaspora or whatever, but because they really don't have a platform.
Exactly. So there are a lot of elements into it, and this is what I did in Being in Time. I tried to understand what are the origins. It's not one origin of this kind of process. And this is why I'm not a Trump supporter, of course, but I regard Trump as a very, very important force in unveiling this type of fragmentation. It was amazing to see that the working class American ended up with him, and they're still with him, by the way, I believe. It was an interesting and I'm going to upset another segment in a second. Give me a second and it comes. What was very clear to me was that white identitarianism performs all those problems. It actually reduced the white nationalist into a subgroup of this moronic identitarian left.
And they use the same language. Many of the white nationalists are using a lot of language of the civil rights movement applied to their own perspective. Yeah,
exactly. So what was and now I remember where I'm getting old, so my thoughts are kind of not linear at all anymore, but I eventually remember all the most important bits. But
you're a musician as well, so you should be forgiven.
So I started to tell you how I tried to fly away from the Jews, but by the time I started to understand what is going on, I realized that this fragmentation and this fight against all kind of conservative ideas and family values, it is something that started with Wilhelm Reich and then the Frankfurt School. They were operating they were both kind of neo-Marxists, but not operating together, but pushing the same ideas. And I managed to show how this is actually a pretty much a Jewish project, and to my great surprise, none of those Jews actually were self-identified Jews. They were not even if they were Jews by ancestry, maybe except Erich Fromm, I think, who was religious was a product of a religious upbringing or education. And none of them were kind of tied to their Jewishness. So this was kind of an assimilatory project. This was their way, maybe even to run away from their Judaism. And when it came to the right, I realized that the most interesting right identitarian, maybe he didn't even call himself identitarian, was Andrew Breitbart. And I was shocked how much he knew about it and how well he understood those products. And then I started to see that every speech I find of him, he never manages to forget to mention his bar mitzvah. And then I realized that, and eventually I found out that the link is the URL is on the net, that Breitbart, the outlet, was actually formed in Jerusalem.
Oh,
yeah, it is. I can send it to you if somebody will ask a question. You know, if people watch us, they can just
they'll be commenting. I'll be interested in seeing.
I was formed in Jerusalem, and they will find the link immediately. Even Google didn't manage to hide this link yet. And there was something amazing. An amazing quote. It's almost verbatim because I don't remember word by word, but Andrew Breitbart said something like that. He said, "Our culture was hijacked. Our culture, our American. I'm not American, but this is Breitbart is American. Our culture was hijacked by a bunch of German scientists who immigrated to this country and took over." And this is very, very problematic.
Is he talking about the CIA's Operation Paperclip to bring...
No, he was talking about the Frankfurt School, his prime enemies. And they were not... This wasn't the right way to describe them. They were Jews who immigrated to America because they ran away from Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
In 1936,
but back then that distinction wasn't being made so much. They were all Germans, and they were probably communists.
For Americans, maybe they were Germans, but they came to America because they had to run for their life. There was a real obviously Hitler took over in 1933, but by 1936, it was very clear to these to the to Frankfurt, Chile, you know that they have to find to escape. It's not going the right way. So even Andrew Breitbart managed to be slightly misleading by design, consciously, here. And this is where my writing is also very upsetting for me. It's very upsetting. It's very upsetting. It is very upsetting to write upsetting things, but I'm just doing it all the time because it is quite upsetting to see.
The world is an upsetting place. I mean, you know, I don't know what to do with it generally. I write. I mean, yeah, there's a... The IDF commits a massacre every Friday. What do you do with that information when it goes on for 2 years, every week after week? What do you do with that? You have to do something with it. I mean, this is just one example. There's just so many things. You have to do something with it. But you also make, and in the 10 minutes we have left, Gilad, you also make incredible music, and which is, it's there's certain people out there who are known, you're also known to many, but for very different things. And then you'll do concerts and concert tours where fans of your music will come who have no interest in your politics or anybody else's politics necessarily, right? And then what's it like? What's it like traveling around and when your shows that don't get canceled, when they do go on and you have this bizarre mix of jazz fans and people coming to protest you? Can any particular anecdotes?
Let me be honest with you. You know, obviously, I have a concert of mine that were cancelled because clubs, for instance, were terrorized. There was a case of a London club. You know that the guy said, "I'm doing the concerts," and he realized that they are going to destroy him. Eventually, it was destroyed by Corona, by COVID. Mm-hmm. But
just so people know out there, I've also had shows canceled because of threats by groups who were so opposed by my views on Israel that they wanted to that they threatened to smash the windows of venues. And this was the anti-Deutsch in Germany, which you've had these problems all over many, many different countries. And my main issues have been just for a certain period of time with this group called the anti-Deutsch. I mean, it's kind of ongoing, but I still end up doing shows in Germany without them being boycotted or attacked.
When this happens to me, I make sure that people know about it, and I believe the truth has this peculiar tendency to unveil itself. Everything comes to light. And there is no way to stop it. And when you try to stop it, you actually expose the fact that there is a bigger story there than we are willing to admit. For me, music, and I think that you will agree with me, and I think that every musician will agree with me, music is the closest thing to truth-telling. Why? If I'll play a phrase for you, I take the guitar and I play something, and I play the wrong notes, you will hear it. If I'll try to be overwhelmingly sophisticated, you will hear it. I said, Gilad, you know, in Britain we call it muso. I don't know how you call it in America. Muso is a kind of someone who would kind of try to play 12 chords when just A minor will do the job. You know, like barely graduates.
Yeah.
When you play fast, when the music, the spirit is really a ballad, people hear it. And to be a great musician is to get rid of this fear and to allow yourself to explore your genuine truth, assuming that there is such a truth in you. A lot of us are afraid because we are not so sure that there is a truth there, you know. I'm now kind of in my late 50s, and I'm making music on an international level, played with, you know, the biggest names and so on and so on. And only now, I'll tell you a funny story that maybe people are interested. You know, I never spoke about it. I never spoke about it, but I should speak about it with you because you are a musician. I will give you a story that kind of brings to light this kind of thing. A few years ago, I was asked to come to play a solo feature or whatever with kind of the last Pink Floyd album. And this is a big thing, Pink Floyd, you know.
Were you working with Roger Waters and?
No. Actually, it's a friend of mine, a student of mine, who is playing saxophone with Roger Waters. But this was a Pink Floyd. It was David Gilmour. It's actually Phil Manzanera produced the album.
Not David Gilmour, right?
Yeah,
the
yeah.
new Pink Floyd. Yeah. What an amazing musician he is.
He is. And ask what to bring. He said, bring the tenor. But, you know, I play with rock, you know, me being a moron in a way. But it saved me, you know. Tenor, maybe, rock and roll, you know, drugs, all the rock. And they probably, I bring everything, you know. I have a big car. I put the baritone, tenor, alto, flutes. And I came to the studio and they played a tune to me. I usually don't like to listen to tunes before I, you know, a lot of people ask, oh, you want to listen? No, I don't. I want to come and to be in the moment and to create. And I listened to the tune and he said that he wants tenor. And after one take or two takes, I realized that he really means it. He really wants tenor. And I do one take, two take, three takes, four takes, and I don't hear it. I mean, I played something. I play the right notes, but it doesn't kill me, you know. It's kind of a big kind of, you know, epic Pink Floyd tune, you know, as big as it can be. And, you know, the sax in Pink Floyd is very different from my sax. It's kind of very rough. And, you know, I play kind of more finesse.
Like Dark Side of the Moon kind of sax.
Yeah. I'm not the Dark Side of the Moon saxophonist at all, you know. I'm pretty much the opposite. And I tell him after quite a few takes, I tell him, you know, I hear something completely different. completely. You know? And I take into consideration the possibility that he would vomit, you know, when he listens to it. I told him, it's a big kind of, you can check it out. It's called Anesina. It's on the net. It's on my website. If you want, I'll send it to you all. It's a kind of very big guitars. And I tell him, listen, I hear Turkish clarinet. You know, and he said, you know, the thing, you know, he's a great musician, and Phil is there, you know, Phil Manzanera, great, really musician. I said, go, you know, do it. I went into the room. I did one take, playing my you know, my Arabic you know, mawal or taksim, if you want to use the Turkish. And I come back to the control, and he said, I see that the whole country is in a state of a shock. And they told me, listen, this is amazing, but you realize that it has nothing. But I felt comfortable with it. I didn't feel, you know, I played a lot of saxophones, and I didn't feel comfortable. They left it. I can play well, you know, but I told him, this is what I hear. This is what I hear on this context. And they told me, listen, David Gilmour told me, you know, it's like I don't, it has really nothing to do with Pink Floyd. This is our last album. I told, listen, man, you want it, take it. You don't want it, you know, don't send it back to me. You know, just erase it. And the album came out. I didn't even know if I was paid and everything. I didn't even know if it made it into the album or not. And then 3 months later, the album came out. 4 months later, and this was the kind of the tune, you know. And they changed the name into a Turkish name, you know.
Ah,
and,
nice.
You know, you know. So because this was the truth that I felt at the moment, and this is the motto of my life, and this is how I write. You know, if this is something that I see all the time, they really want to destroy me. Yeah, so it's very bizarre thing. So they chop my quotes.
Mm-hmm.
They make me saying things that I've never said. Now, people who are doing that. You know what kind? I always ask myself, what if you don't like me? Surely you know what you don't like me. Why do you have to doctor my quotes? It is so strange.
I haven't met a critic of yours who's actually read one of your books. Never once. They've always read some.
Exactly, Ali Abu Nima, who allegedly wrote the letter. I know that he didn't write the letter. He actually admitted to Professor Norton Mazvinsky one day before that he never read anything by me.
I can't believe, I mean, and I know people have said, well, if he said this in this one paragraph, then that's convincing enough to me and I can denounce him. But I just couldn't understand it. Like, why, if you're going to actually take the step of not just ignoring somebody, but actually disavowing them, you know, publicly, you better know who
there
you're
was
talking
nothing,
about.
There was nothing. I said, if I'm so bad, try to find one thing that you can point it in my book.
Well, or in the book. I mean, of course, you have a great sense of humor and you're often making dark jokes.
They don't go for my, they don't even criticize me for my humor, but it happened before. But for instance, you know, there is this kind of that I said, you know, this is a quote of mine that they use, that I said that Hitler was right after all. And what I actually say in the book is the complete opposite, that Israel, that is pushing so much for war in Iran, should take into consideration that this war can escalate into a nuclear conflict quite easily. It's the scenario is quite clear. And if this happens, and thousands or tens of thousands, or hundreds of thousands, a million people are dead or poisoned, some people may be bold enough, this is a quote, may be bold enough to say, oh my God, Hitler was right after all. And then I say, our job is to prevent it.
Right. So they chop, you they know, just they, twisted they, it completely.
Prevent it and to make sure that Israel understands this possible scenario. So, you know, and this is, by the way, something that I think that the first person to do it with the Wandering Who was actually Alan Dershowitz.
To twist it around like that completely?
Yeah, it is something that he's doing.
He does it all the time.
He does it all the time. But for me, it's kind of always kind of, I felt kind of reassuring, you know, if somebody, as people are so kind of using such a banal tactics, try to think you play a song and they play it in reverse, you know, and they say, look what, like, yeah. Silly music, you know, you cannot sing. All right, you know, so it's like, no, it's you play it the other way around. You know, I don't understand it, but the fact is that all those people who were after me, they are now battling to defend their right to speak. I don't have to defend my right to speak. You know why? Because people want to listen to that which I have to say.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Well, next time we need to talk a little bit more about music. But I mean, that was a wonderful conversation.
By the way, it's the first time that I mentioned this Pink Floyd story. You know, so
I love it.
If you cut it,
yeah.
It was an amazing experience.
That's great. Yeah, I love it. Yeah. Wonderful
Thanks
story.
So much, man. Great to see you, and I hope that we play.
Yeah, yeah, me too.
Are you in Portland now?
Yeah, I'm in Portland. You know, I always used to think that having fans in different countries was sort of like good insurance for like if whatever might happen, you know, you always had work. But now with the global pandemic, I didn't realize that there never thought of global pandemic as an option.
Pandemic, not exactly pandemic, but tell me one thing. Was it a good period for you or upsetting?
At first, it was really hard emotionally, having all the tours canceled and not knowing anything about what was going to happen and all the schools canceling and everything. But then I started doing broadcasts several times a week and creating more structure for my life. And then I was fine. And yeah. So, yeah, I mean, and we're surviving okay, but it's just terrible. I mean, it feels like looking out at a valley that's burning, and literally we're looking at a valley that's burning while you're in a place that's not burning, you know. I mean, that's lately it's all been burning, so it's a fire.
Yeah.
But in so many ways.
You know, yesterday the British Chancellor came with a crazy statement that musicians should get used to the idea that they will have to do a kind of new career training.
Yeah, how about the idea of universal basic income? Because of course we're all losing, all these careers are disappearing. I mean, the music industry is less than 20% the size of what it was 20 years ago, and that's true for publishing. And that's true for, of course,
this is before Corona.
Before Corona, right? Before Corona, our industry had collapsed already, and so many other industries. So the idea of
by the way, it never collapsed. It was basically closed down. They moved the people who, you know, if you were dealing with major record companies, you would know that we were not dealing. When I started, are we the same age?
You're just a few years older. Yeah,
so when I started, you know, because, you know, I'm a producer as well. You know, when I started musician, kind of my proper music career and being producer, I was still dealing with musicians in the role in the record companies. And eventually they all became kind of accountants. Mm-hmm. All right. So it the industry didn't die. They move into real estate or whatever. They moved into investing in different. And this is by the way, it's a very interesting topic, and nobody speaks about it. Our generation, we collected a lot of vinyls and then CDs and books and then DVDs. And instruments. I don't want to think how many guitars you have. Can't imagine how many musical instruments. You know, I'm in my music room here, and I have microphones that I collected all of. When I look at my kids and their peers, they have nothing. They have a pillow and a blanket, The music, the films, everything is streamed. Everything is in the computer. They don't own anything. And basically, all they do is paying rent for a room. When we were young, we can still thought of buying a house to put all the guitars and the CDs.
Yeah.
You know,
they
may just live in very small condos or when I was in Portland, for instance, you see all those kind of beautiful houses that are erased and you come the next year and it's condos.
Yeah.
You know, and there was a transition, a very frightening transition where publishing, music, cinema, all those industries collapsed and became kind of a streaming day kind of a, and the artists were the last concern for those I don't want to say motherfuckers, so I won't. But
when Spotify started their free streaming tier, that's when in 2013, you know, that was a seminal year for me when the CD sales just fell through the floor. I don't know if that was a particular year for you, but I've talked to other musicians who say 2013 was a big one in terms of suddenly not selling merch anymore.
You know, it is very funny with the band, the Orient House Ensemble, from 2009, I tell them kind of every time, this is probably our last album, last album, last album, last album. And I always kept selling CDs, you know.
Wow.
Kept selling CDs till the end. But I think that there was a drop. There was a drop. There was a time in 2009 that I could sell sometime even 100 CDs because we played in theaters and stuff like that. A night, because there is a limit of how many CDs you can sell. Because how many people are selling the CDs? You
see exactly. Because people are only going to wait in line for so long. So you need to have four or six people doing it at the same time as soon as the show is over, right?
So kind of that we go to the capacity. But even in January, we launched my wife's album, and we did one or two gigs, and then there was lockdown in 2 weeks later. This is where it ended. But I must admit that I had the Orient House album ready, and I'm not going to print it. I'm going to put it on the site, and I'll tell people, if you like it, drop us something or whatever.
And are you guys managing to survive since all the gigs were canceled and everything?
I'm doing sessions.
So that's still happening.
I do. I'm doing sessions, and I realized I we are in the same situation. For the last 30 years, I have been I never been in any place more than 2 days, 3 days. I was touring.
And now
I was afraid to stop. I was afraid to be at home. You know, because I was married, I don't know, for 30 years. I thought, you know, as the year passed by, you know, I think, you know, if you come home, you know, the kids, you know.
Being away a lot, that kind of creates a nice sort of variety to everything, and nobody can get tired of anybody. You know, I always thought that was good, but being home is really special too. Has it been good generally home all that time?
It is an amazing. It was an amazing experience for me. You know, kind of I kind of learned to play the saxophone. Because I started to play when I was 17, and immediately I became a saxophonist. So I didn't go to study or anything, you know. So I started, like yourself, I started to give workshops, and I had to think all week long what I'm going to work on. So I had to practice it and how to explain it. It is spiritually, this COVID-19 isn't was a very interesting experience.
No doubt.
Hey.
Yeah. I better go take care of children. But it's been really great talking to you, Gilad.
Beautiful, man. Let's do it again.
Let's Bye-bye. Do it again. Absolutely. Bye-bye. Take care. Bye-bye. And thanks for joining and listening in on Discussions with David for this Wednesday. And I'll be back doing another episode on Friday, talking with another musician named Charlie King from Massachusetts, fantastic songwriter. And then in November, probably we'll be moving the time to 11 o'clock. But for the rest of this month, it'll be 10 o'clock. I'll keep you posted on any of that. And yeah. Remember, don't pay the rent. Mutual aid will get us through. And I'll see you around in cyberspace or elsewhere. Take care. Bye for now.